Welcome to WISO Weekend, the home of WISO-produced news and features. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up on today's program, one woman, one mission, and one tiny house. We'll tell you how they're connected, and you'll hear from the founders of a new collaborative writing group called the Dayton Writers Movement. First, let's answer a question. Have you ever noticed the blue helicopters in the sky above the Miami Valley? Those are care flights, air ambulances from Miami Valley Hospital. Rocky Blazer, a listener from Springfield, says they seem to fly out a lot and ask why the hospital would decide to send out a care flight rather than a traditional ambulance. WISO intern Char Dastin investigated.
I walk through a heavy double door onto the helipad at the Miami Valley Hospital. It's an overcast day, but I can still see the tree-covered hills on the other side of the highway. Pilot Earl Daniels leads me over to the clean-looking blue helicopter and helps me into the cockpit.
Just swing your right leg through the cockpit. There you go.
Inside, every surface is covered by a gauge or dial or GPS screen. Daniels tells me they need all that equipment when there's low visibility.
Just like your big airliners, we fly around in the clouds based off of our radio instruments.
If it's an instrument type flight, it's climbing with whatever airspeed and altitude I have programmed into it.
We go around back to the cabin for the patients and nurses. It's got a low ceiling, but it's pretty spacious.
It can carry two patients. We can carry a 750-pound patient if needed.
Conditions for patients and nurses are different than on the ground.
When we're flying night vision goggles, normally it's either a blue or a green light in the cabin.
And are those noise-canceling headphones?
Those are. So actually, if they are able to, we put those on the patient to help reduce the noise that they're exposed to during transport.
Mandy Vai is a flight nurse and the outreach manager for CareFlight. Back in her office, she tells me that flight nurses have to know almost as much about flying as they do about nursing.
People don't realize it's also aviation. It's safety. So now you're wearing night vision goggles and you're training to look at, you know, what are obstacles in the sky. You're operating radios, you're calling in a radio report on your patient that you just met 5 minutes ago. It's like nursing, but it's multitasking to the next degree.
But we still haven't answered our listener's question. Why would the hospital, or emergency medical service, send out a care flight instead of an ambulance? Vi says it's either a patient's doctor or an emergency medical worker at the scene of an accident that calls care flight. The decision to call is less about what kind of medical problem patients have and more about just how quickly they need to get to the hospital.
Time is muscle. We transport everybody. We transport pregnancy all the way up to the realm of all of it. So you have your trauma patients that you'll see from a scene. We also can do, we'll fly out to somebody's house if they're having a heart attack.
CareFlight helicopters are stationed at the Miami Valley Hospital and at local airports in Lebanon and Urbana. They're the only air ambulances between Cincinnati and Columbus, and they also fly to places outside the Miami Valley.
We actually do a lot of interfacility transports as well, so if they need to go to Cleveland because that's where their transplant physician is, then they're going to go to Cleveland and we'll take them there.
Here's pilot Earl Daniels again.
So if we cruise at 150 knots, which is about 173 miles per hour, I can reach Cleveland in an hour, Lexington in 40 minutes, Indianapolis in about 40 to 45 minutes. And all those destinations that I've been to all of them. And we do them quite often, as a matter of fact.
Flights are usually pretty quick, but Vi says there's a strong relationship between flight nurses and patients, which doesn't end when the helicopter lands.
I know for me, when I'm flying with a patient, we're talking to them. I always put my hand on their shoulder. I'm talking to them. I'm telling them this is what's going on. You meet them sometimes on the worst day of their life, and you will build a relationship. You know, we have some that, you know, come back up and visit. You know, some of us have had we've flown patients in our community. So we actually get to see them back in the community with their family and know that, you know, you were part of helping them get back there.
The CareFlight staff are only a small part of the huge team it takes to rehabilitate a patient.
Nurses, physicians, physical therapists, occupational therapists, dietary, you know, all the way out to discharge and getting them back home. It takes hundreds of people.
But playing even a small part means a lot of work. Flights, combined with ground ambulances, transported more than 5,400 patients last year. And Vi told me it's not unusual for CareFlight's three helicopters to be busy all day. For WISO Curious, I'm WISO intern Char Dastin.
Why So Curious is our occasional series where you ask questions and our reporters answer them online and on air. Visit WISO.org to tell us what you're curious about. Vera Strzok knows all about reinventing herself. She's had several careers that you'll hear about in this interview ahead, but it's her latest mission that piqued our interest. Strzok is traveling across the country promoting sustainable living, and she's not doing it alone. She's getting help from her tiny house, which she's hauling behind her every step or wheel rotation of the way. No easy task for your average person. Then again, Strzok is anything but average. We found that out when she and her tiny house, the Silver Bullet, rolled through Yellow Springs last week. You've been traveling across country. Tell us a little bit about your trip. Where did you start? How far have you gone? And let's talk about some of the people you meet and their reaction to this tiny house.
Well, I think the reaction is, first of all, they love it. It's cute. You know, I can't go anywhere. I can't go to a rest stop. I cannot go to a gas station without hordes of people coming up to me. I finally made a little sign. I've got to go pee. I'll be right back. You know, because it's hysterical. You know, they just love the whole movement. And I'm sure that's because of all the tiny house shows and everything. And they want to know about it. So I have a little set of cards I give them. I talk to them. I answer questions, especially the kids. I love having kids come up and look at this. And frankly, the reception is extremely positive. Every tour and workshop that was organized coming out from Massachusetts, like I think my first stop was Benjamin Obdyke, who's one of my sponsors. They make the rain screens that I used. And just hundreds of people wanted to see, what is it all about? You know, what does it really mean to live tiny? Can you really do this? Be like 3 feet from nature in any direction? And I'm like, yeah, I have lots of windows. Everything's fine. I go anywhere I want. So the reception is extremely positive. There are a few people who do come in, though, who say, gosh, this is about the size of my shoe closet. But, you know, they're more tiny house curious than tiny house enthusiasts or tiny house transitioners, which is most of what comes in through my doors. It cost me $19,820, of which $6,500 is the solar and $4,200 was the foundation base. I decided to buy a new trailer. And all of it can be unscrewed and taken apart and reused. That was part of also the Silver Bullet Challenge, was to be able to have every part of it available for reclamation.
Where did you start your trip?
Okay, it's a summer tour. June 1st, I left the shores of Newburyport, where Massachusetts meets New Hampshire. And I went down to Philly. I did a whole thing with the meetup groups and one of my sponsors. And then I went to my friend's winery at Chalk Hill, PA. That was a dangerous mountain to get up in the rain, let me tell you. Gorgeous vintner, award-winning at Chalk Hill, PA, near the Falling Water Frank Lloyd Wright building. And as I moved across the country, I met with meetup groups and allowed them to come and tour and talk tiny. And as I headed out towards the Tiny House Jamboree, which is where I ended up, I spoke there and did a sustainable lifestyle design workshop. I had two wonderful guinea pigs. No, I mean volunteers, who went through the first two exercises. And so I have a book out. It's an e-book, How Sustainable Is That? And that tells you all about my journey and build. Then I have a companion workbook that runs you through 10 steps of how to transition into your own sustainable lifestyle, whether it's in a tiny house on wheels, tiny house on foundation, or wherever you are in your life's journey.
Any conflicts in the tiny house?
Like any movement, there are those who come in to make money off the movement, etc. My feeling basically is that we should be inclusive and sustainable. We should open our hearts to those. It's okay to make money off the movement, okay? But I would prefer, you know, because most of the DIYers are sustainable thinkers. I think the builders come in from an RV standpoint and trying to meet RVIA requirements. And as you may or may not know, every city, state, county treats RVs differently. You know, how long you can stay. You know, like in Massachusetts, even my toilet's illegal. There's even a separate or Nature's Head compost toilet's illegal. So what we are trying to do as a movement, I believe, is educate our town officials, educate people about this is an affordable option. You know, this is an option for people who can no longer get into a $300,000 or $400,000 house because our wages, you know, aren't at the level where we can even afford something that's $100,000. So, you know, consider this an alternative lifestyle that you can embrace because we are building them safely, DIYers or other builders. And so I don't know if there's any conflict within the movement per se, except town officials don't understand what we're doing. So what I try to do, like I took all my 20 drawings to my building inspector in the town. I talked to the planning board. I said, look, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. I'm living a smaller footprint so I can put the money that I do have back into the community and support the community. You know, can you embrace something like that, a tiny house village, you know, a tiny house pocket neighborhood? And that's happening all over. In fact, two of our tiny house leaders, Alexis Hart Stevens and her partner Christian, just did a movie about Living Tiny Legally Part 1, where it actually has town officials from all over the country talking about the acceptance of this kind of movement.
You mentioned safety several times. Have you ever felt in your travels in danger personally or for the house while you're transporting this across country?
That's a good one because, you know, I'm known for staying at truck stops. And, you know, I think I did a whole blog. My first blog about the summer tour was about the danger of parking in a truck stop that you don't realize first time out, because that's the nation's commerce that's parking next to you. You've got 99 other trucks near you, and they have chemicals, they have all kinds of stuff that, you know, could burn a city down. But that's what's traveling on our highways, too. So I thought, you know, here I am, I'm already parked, I'm locked into position. You know, I guess I'll have to take my chances, you know. But that happens if I were driving next to a semi, you know, and they accidentally hit a car in front of me, behind me, or me. So that's the kind of risk you have to take. In terms of safety, I really would like to ask everyone to consider when they plan and design, you know, whether you're buying a shell, whether you're having a builder build for you, you know, really do your due diligence and make sure that they're building to code or above code, because we're moving on a highway, and so you have to consider racking and all kinds of physics, which I did. I mean, my building inspector looked at me and he goes, this thing is so overbuilt. You've got so many Simpson ties in here. You know, if it goes anywhere, it's going in one piece. It'll never really fall apart. And I said, I think I did overbuild it because I was over-concerned about that. So I just ask that people make sure their builders or they themselves, you know, are into knowing what the code is and either get to it or exceed it so that you feel safe in your house. And make sure, just like, you know, when I was a single-engine pilot, you have to do your flight check every time you move this thing. And you have to go around and make sure your tires are safe, everything's right, just like a trucker does on a rig.
And how's your stop here in Yellow Springs been?
Oh, amazing. Amazing, Jerry. I can't tell you. It's a wonderful little enclave of, you know, these charming, wonderful little shops and restaurants. And what was an amazing observation of mine, because fellow tiny houser Heidi Dotson took me all around for a tour after we all met. And you have many, many small homes under 1,200 feet in this city alone. I felt like I was already in a tiny house village. So, you know, when she invited me to come out here, and I couldn't believe her until I actually saw it. And there is one other tiny house in town. I saw it. We went and hunted it down, actually. And so Yellow Springs has been very receptive, and it was a wonderful place to stay. And thanks for letting me hang out behind the radio station. That was cool.
So you're wrapping up the summer tour, heading back to New England. What's next for you?
Well, actually, I chose a 3-month period because I wanted to see how people received sustainable education. You know, whether it was just a movement where they just wanted the look of the tiny house or the idea of a mobile thing, or whether they were really concerned about having clean energy and lowering their footprint like most of the DIYers who began the movement and reclamation. I'm going back. I'm not sure quite how. I might actually go through upstate New York. And this is my kind of free period. I might end up in Montreal. I have friends up there. But I'll head back. I have a few tiny houser folks to see. And then when I get back, I'm actually going up to Deke's summer camp. A couple times a year, he has me come and speak and facilitate things. And I love building his tree houses. He's got a great little compound up there with tons of micro shelters. So a bunch of us tiny housers go up there and commune, you know, in his lovely summer camp. And then after that, I have speaking engagements at different festivals. You know, I'll be at St. Augustine at the Tiny House Festival there. I have other commitments as well, but they're so far advanced out that I have no idea what I'll be doing other than this everywhere I go. I'm trying to keep the travel down to 3 months a year because it's $200 of gas a day to move this thing. And that's not a small investment, you know, when you think about it, when you're traveling all those days. So, yeah, it's tough to haul 9,800 pounds.
My final question for you would be, how has this journey into tiny houses and across the country changed you personally or affected your life? How do you feel about what you're doing?
I think when a group of children hold samples of my building envelope and I see this, you know, all the wonderful sparks in their eyes about understanding what that means, and they're so excited to take it back to their environmental science teacher, I know that I must be doing something right. When I see people who are other cancer survivors like me, you know, I'm 3 times, and they come up to me and say, "You've given me hope." You know, I was just kind of a lump on a log and thinking I could never have something I owned and affordable housing. I could never have a life of adventure. You're doing it. And that make, you know, when I get that kind of feedback, I think I must be doing something right, you know, and that's what encourages me to continue.
Vera Strzok, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck on the rest of your travels.
Oh, thanks, Jerry, for having me.
Vera Strzok and her tiny house, the Silver Bullet, making their way across the country to promote sustainable living. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Despite yoga's increasing popularity across the United States, few yoga classes can be found in rural areas. Community Voices producer Arwen Donahue explores the challenges of practicing and teaching yoga in the small farming community of Carlisle, Kentucky.
Jenny Gore works full-time as a police dispatcher. Her shifts are long, sometimes 12 hours, and she's often on the road. It's a hectic schedule, and there's no shortage of stress in her life. Still, she tries to make room for yoga. In fact, she's surprised at how important yoga has become to her.
I think you see the whole Om meditation thing. I had no idea that it, you know, it was stretching and just toning, and the breathing was a big thing too, in learning how to breathe and doing it with the motions. I finally just went to a class and just fell in love with it immediately. I was like, yes, I've definitely got to stick with this.
Jenny takes yoga classes whenever she can at the YMCA in Carlisle. She's grateful to have access to this class in a region where staying healthy is a challenge. The smoking rate is high, life expectancy is low. The county's hospital closed in 2014. Many residents travel 20 miles or more to see a doctor. Jenny has a friend whose doctor is in Lexington, an hour away.
I have a best friend who just been going through the breast cancer thing, and she had it in her lymph nodes, and her doctor told her that she needed to do yoga. I've always tried to get her to exercise with me, but it's easier for me. She lives in Fleming County quite a ways, but she did say she would like to come to yoga here in Carlisle. It just hasn't happened for her yet.
With a population of just under 2,000, Carlisle is lucky to have its own YMCA. 9 students fill the small room during this Thursday lunch hour class.
I take this opportunity to transition onto your mat, stepping into this moment as it flows into the next one.
Jenny Lee is the yoga teacher at the Carlisle Y. She has to drive almost an hour from her home in Robertson County to get here. She says she feels as if she lives in a yoga desert.
You know, I'm teaching currently, but I don't teach in my home county. I have to drive, you know, a couple counties in either direction to teach. We've lived here for about a year and a half, and I've spent a lot of that time puzzling over the best way to introduce people to yoga. A lot of folks around here, if they're lucky enough to have a job, it's in a factory that's a county over, and they probably work a 12-hour shift. And then they've probably got a farm for people who are working at least two jobs and trying to raise families. There's no space in their day-to-day life where yoga really fits in very well.
Jenny herself lives on a farm and made a living as a farmer before becoming a yoga teacher.
I know that during my truck farming days, if I had had yoga, I would have been a lot more comfortable. There's a lot of repetitive use tensions that you create when you're hoeing 400 feet of carrots or whatever.
Most of the people in Jenny Lee's yoga class at the Carlisle Y are retirees. She's happy for their presence in her class, but is always thinking about how to bring yoga to more people, especially those who may not know they need it.
I would love to do a yoga for farmers class, but I don't think anybody would come.
For WYSO Community Voices, I'm Arwen Donahue.
For more Community Voices stories and information on our training program, visit WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 FM. And thanks for joining us online at WYSO.org. When Chris and Megan Burnside moved to Dayton about a year ago, they immediately saw a thriving arts community and say they were also drawn to a lot of the collaborative work that was taking place between various artists and organizations. They've jumped headlong into that collaborative creativity and co-founded a new group called the Dayton Writers Movement. The two, along with a group of local actors, are launching a new podcast this month called Unwritten. This week we talked about the podcast and what's behind the Dayton Writers Movement. Chris and Megan, thanks for speaking with us today. Megan, tell us a little bit about the Dayton Writers Movement and your mission.
Dayton Writers Movement started with a core group of writers at the University of Dayton, a lot of previous students of Chris's, and they all got together wanting to do a collaborative writing project. And in doing so, we wanted to be able to give them a voice so it wasn't just on a computer. Instead, it was a piece that could be shared with the world.
Yeah, so a lot of these students are students that I had worked with directly, and they were looking for some kind of collaborative project. We had everything from people who were doing screenwriting to people who were poets, to people who were writing songs and music and lyrics. And they wanted to do something that allowed them to all work together. And that's when we decided that we would put this project together. And then initially, it was just going to be scripts that we wrote. And what we've done with that is taken the scripts that we've written, and after all of the writing and editing process, we've then gone and put together the cast, which is 26 local performers from the Dayton and Ohio area. And then what we've done is produce that in terms of going to a studio and recording it in a professional studio, Megafauna Sound here in Dayton, and then editing and mixing and mastering it there as well so that we have this full complete project.
You've got 26 actors and how many writers on this project?
There are 8 total writers.
Tell me a little bit about the artistic process.
So it started with the 8 of us just in a room working on coming up with a story. We came together with no particular story in mind, and the 8 of us just kept throwing out ideas, some of them very, very disparate ideas that had nothing to do with each other, and trying to figure out how can we put these ideas together and make a story that makes sense. And over weeks of meetings, those ideas kind of boiled down to a core story. And then we just kept developing that story as we went, mostly just by sitting around and talking about it. And eventually we got to the point where we assigned each writer one of the 8 episodes. And those writers started going off and writing their individual episodes while still talking about them as a group. And then once all of those episodes came in, one of the writers, Anna Adamy, and I went through and edited all of the episodes to make sure that the story fit and it was cohesive. And then it was put to the performers, and it turned into more of the production phase, which was rehearsing, recording, and making sure that that all of those pieces were in place.
You're going to launch the podcast on August 28th?
Yes, we're going to be having a premiere at the Neon Theater in Dayton. And then also shortly after, we will be launching the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. All of the links are available on Facebook and on our website, unwrittenpodcast.com. And we're really excited about it. One other thing we did not mention is that the movement part of Dayton Writers Movement is very important, and you will hear it in the podcast. So our podcast tackles some pretty serious and mature issues like suicide, sexual violence. We wanted to bring those up so that we could have smart conversations as a community and also bring it up in a way that's entertaining. So it's not a heavy podcast. It is a podcast that has a lot of humor in it and a lot of heart. And we're really excited to have that movement element to all of our pieces that we're going to do. Another social issue that we felt needed to be talked about or at least addressed is the lack of strong female characters in entertainment. So we made a conscious effort to create a show that showcases strong, complex women characters. And equality for women is important for us, and not just in the podcast. It's also important for us from a business side. Half our writers are female. So the writers' room is full of varied opinions and varied ideas that they're bringing to the table and experiences, which I think really lends validity to the story that is being told. And the rest of the cast is also pretty equally split between male and female.
Before coming to Dayton, is this the type of community engagement that you've been involved in, or is this a totally new project for both of you?
For the most part, it's very new. All the writing that I've done in the past has been very solitary, at the very least. I've written stage plays, but then I'm mostly sitting in a room writing, and then they're produced with little involvement from me. So it was when we came to Dayton that we realized that the arts community here is extremely collaborative, and emphasis on the word community. Everybody comes together. They all know each other. It's really interesting to hold auditions and have our kickoff meeting with all of our performers and have these 26 people in a room. And a lot of them are looking around saying, I know that person. I know that person. And it's just such a wonderful, tight community that we've not really experienced anywhere else that we've lived.
Have you thought about what's next? I mean, you're launching your first project, but where do you want the Dayton Writers Movement to go?
We anticipate doing future productions, potentially plays, short stories, a variety of creative projects. We're not limiting ourselves just to podcasts, but we hope to interact with the writers and the actors and the fantastic talent here in Dayton.
You've also got an original score or music that accompanies the podcast. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, the theme song for Unwritten was written by Joey Ferber, who's also one of the writers of the show. And he performed it with some other local artists, Kelsey Mills and Ian Mortensen. And then we recorded that at Megafauna Sound as well.
I've got it all. It's just unwritten. Not putting it off. Just trying to figure it out. If what I say comes to fruition with these words, I can't play around. Who I am can't really be bad.
The podcast is called Unwritten, and again, where can folks find out the details? The start date is coming up.
Yes, so it premieres on August 28th, and the first episode releases on major podcast networks on September 1st, and listeners can get more information at unwrittenpodcast.com, where they can download episodes and read information about our story.
Megan and Chris Burnside, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, you can find out more about the Dayton Writers Movement at unwrittenpodcast.com. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 8. Thanks for joining us. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis and the Book Nook.